Good morning. Let's do the opening chant. An unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. As I mentioned earlier, today is spring equinox. And as you may already know, the equinox is when the both day and night are essentially the same length. And this is caused by the alignment of the center of the sun with our equator. And as you can imagine, spring equinox is pretty significant in many cultures. But what I want to talk about today is how spring equinox is understood in Japan. And because the day and night are roughly of equal length, this time becomes a liminal space, a place in which there's a balance, a place of entrance which can be achieved through things that are normally considered opposites, such as birth and death. Liminal space is a time between what was and what is coming up. It's a place of transition. It's a season of waiting, of not knowing. And liminal space is also where transformation takes place, if we learn to wait and let it form us. So for this reason, equinoxes, because there are two, is a time of interacting with spirit ancestors in East Asia, and to acknowledge their presence during this in-between state that allows a kind of communication to happen, or communion to happen with our ancestors. So in the Nichiren tradition, Nichiren Buddhism, it's called Higan, which interestingly means paramita, are to arrive at the other shore. So the equinox becomes a kind of a time of communication between our Saha world and Nirvana. And people visit their relatives, they clean their graves, they leave flowers. It goes on for actually about a week. And in the Jodo Shinshu Buddhist tradition, it is called Ohiga, or Great Paramita. So this is the great activity of crossing over to the other shore. And there's this sense of being able to connect with harmony, that these two great forces of light and dark, birth and death, delusion and realization, become a kind of in-betweenness, an entering in between these two dichotomies. And therefore, it's believed that because of this, we are more able to cultivate selflessness, discipline, diligence, patience, loving kindness, and wisdom. So that's one of the teachings of the Jodo Shinshu school. So the equinox is this time of stillness. In Soto Zen, we might think of equinox as recalling the Sandokai, the harmony of difference and samsara, difference and sameness, which was written by Sekito Kisen, our Buddhist ancestor from the 8th century. So a line from the Sandokai is, light and dark oppose one another like the front and back foot walking. Each has its merit expressed according to function and place. And if you think about it, we could not walk with one foot. Both are necessary. And when both are functioning, this is the harmony of difference and unity, or difference and sameness, functioning together. It is the equality of light and life, light and dark. It is birth and death. It is all of these things that we tend to think of as being separate events, and yet they are both required for this total functioning. So You will not be surprised, if you have been listening to my lectures for a while, to know that I was curious about what Dogen might have said about the spring equinox. So I looked in the Eihokuroku, which is the Dogen's extensive records, which is a compilation of things that he said. They're usually fairly short, and they're usually given at specific occasions. So here's what I found. The Dharma Hall Discourse number 73, and it's called Memory of Spring. Here's what Dogen said. The voice is a sense object. Without being able to rely on what is external, can you bring forth one phrase for this mountain monk, Dogen? And then Dogen paused. And then he said, I always remember Jiangyan in the third month when the partridges sing and 100 blossoms open. I always remember Jiangyan in the third month when the partridges sing and 100 blossoms open. Ooh. What could this be about? Well, actually, Dogen is paraphrasing koan. And the koan is from the Mumon Kan, which means gateless gate, a 13th century koan collection. It's case 24. It's called Leaving Speech and Silence Behind. And the teacher in this koan is named Fuketsu in Japanese. His name is Feng Shui in Chinese, and he lived in the 10th century in China. Okay, so here's the main case. I'm going to use the Japanese names. The main case is a monk asks the priest, Fuketsu, both speech and silence transgress. Both speech and silence transgress. How can we avoid this transgression? Fuketsu said, I often think of Konan in March. The partridges chirp among the many scented flowers. So here's a koan again. Both speech and silence transgress. How can we avoid this transgression? Fuketsu said, I often think of Konan in March. The partridges chirp among the many scented flowers. So the question essentially is, of the monk, the monk's question essentially is, both speaking and being silent are wrong. How can I avoid being wrong? That's a question we often ask ourselves. How can I avoid being wrong? And Fuketsu's response to this is, I always think of Konan in March. Partridges chirp among the many fragrant flowers. So, why is Dogen paraphrasing this koan and then quoting the poem? He's quoting this poem to talk about the importance of the equinox. Like the poem, merging of difference and sameness, we have this question of how do we negotiate opposites? Are things that seem to be oppositional to us? And in the case of the equinox, negotiating opposites are finding that place in them in which there's this full functioning becomes a liminal space in which we can fully express and enact something important beyond the dichotomies of this and that that we often get caught in. So, as human beings, we get caught on one side or the other because our minds seem to be very binary for the most part. And so, this liminal space, this relaxed, open, in-between space, becomes a place we can enter and have a deeper experience of openness and freedom from binary tendencies. So that's why Dogen is quoting this koan on the equinox, the spring equinox, because he's thinking about going beyond the this or that of our life And actually, this is a huge teaching in Zen. How do we get beyond our likes and dislikes, if you will? How do we get beyond our preconceived ideas about practice, about doctrine, about life? How do we get beyond these and actually respond to what is happening in the moment in a way that's inclusive of the totality of that moment, of everyone that's part of that moment, and ourself as well? So if we look, go back to the koan and look at this, what's being translated as speech and silence are actually technical terms in Chinese, ri and wei, which are terms from a 5th century Buddhist master who was named Sheng Zhao. And so these are considered two aspects of what's called the Great Way. Ri refers to separating from difference to a kind of silence. And thus we might say it is the absolute or emptiness of Zen. That's what we, how we would call it in Zen. So it refers to separating from difference to a kind of silence. And so, again, we might call this the absolute. Wei refers to a subtle and mysterious ways that form expresses the Great Way. So it's associated with form, expression, speech. So from this perspective, if we look at it here, with the original meaning of this question, from the perspective, the words become words and silence imply li and wei. How can one penetrate and be free from both without error? I don't think we need to worry too much about the technical aspects of this, but I just wanted to make you aware of that. But I do think we need to be aware of this question that we have. And again, here is the translation. A monk asked the priest Fuketsu, both speech and silence transgress. How can we avoid this transgression? Fuketsu said, I often think of Konan in March. The partridges chirp among the many scented flowers. So the monk saying, asking this question about being caught, wanting to be right, he's asking, which one of these is better? Is it better to be silent? Is it better to be somehow aligned more with the absolute than with form? Or is it better somehow to be more aligned with form than the absolute? On one side, this is the aspect of emptiness, no inherently existing. And on the other, we have form, phenomena, things, persons, situations. And the monk doesn't know which one is better. Which one is better? Which is the better way to respond? So he doesn't understand that one or the other is not enough. That we have to respond with both and go beyond both. We have to go beyond the dichotomies in our mind that there's some separation between the two. Remember, in the Heart Sutra says, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Form itself is emptiness, emptiness itself is form. Dogen says, form is form, emptiness is emptiness, in his commentary on the Heart Sutra. When he says form is form, he's also saying emptiness is emptiness, because he's saying form and emptiness are not different. So when you say form, you say emptiness, and when you say emptiness, you say form. Nevertheless, as Zen students, we get caught in this. We might spend a lot of time trying to figure out the question, what is emptiness? Because usually we get caught in some that go down this sort of dead-end street about nihilism before we can come back. Or we're confused and we don't understand that lack of inherent existence and compassion are exactly the same thing. We usually get form pretty quickly, but sometimes we get stuck there. We start to define the whole of realization as trying to find the absolute or emptiness, somehow trying to live in this thing called emptiness and avoiding our life of form, not realizing that there is no difference between the two. This notion of bifurcating them is a conceptual way of being able to understand something about the nature of reality so that we can incorporate them into our hearts and minds and thus work from that place. They are not about being stuck in the concept itself as separate events. They are the same thing. So we end up searching for something called oneness, and we reject the messiness of our life. And sometimes being stuck like this can be very subtle. In this koan, the monk indicates that she understands that standing apart from life is not it, and focusing entirely on the form side is also not it. So she is asking, how can I express the great way? Do I express it in my daily life of form, or do I reject that life and take up a life of silence? So, as in many koans, Fuketsu will not answer the question that is asked, not in the way that the questioner was hoping that they would receive an answer. One commentator says that he responds to the secret question with the secret answer. You know, when students ask questions, they may not know how to formulate the question. And that's not surprising, because when we don't know the answer to the question that we're asking, and I hope if we're asking questions that we don't know the answer. So when we're asking questions and we don't know the answer, how in the world can we formulate the question in a way that might engender the answer if we don't know what the question is? Or we don't know what the answer is. So there's this way in which the teacher may answer the question that is not asked. When I was at Tassajara, Kobun Shino came down there, and he was there for a practice period for 3 months. He was really good at this. He was really good at people would ask questions, and then he would say things that were total non sequiturs. But, you know, for those of us who were practicing with this person, it might have been a non sequitur to them, but it was really clear to us what he was saying. So we say that the teacher answers the question that was not asked, the deeper question. So sometimes this comes from knowing how students think in general, having been there ourselves, knowing what this question is, where it's coming from. And sometimes it comes from just knowing the person themselves, knowing what they need to work on. Knowing what they can't see. Because how can we see? We can't always see what it is we're up to. We can't always see what it is we're doing that's unskillful. So here in this, what might the unasked question be? So perhaps it's something like, I'm caught in philosophical musing, and I'm only seeing my practice through that lens. Because remember, in the original koan, he was talking about this re and way business, which sounds pretty heady to me. So he's caught in a kind of philosophical musing, and he says, I'm only seeing my practice through that lens, so how can I understand and be free from my one-sided view? From my mind's insistence on philosophizing. How can I meet my life authentically? That might be the unasked question, really. How can I meet my life authentically? So, in the case of what Fuketsu said, the answer that he gave is unexpected to the student. The student wanted a binary answer. The student wanted to know, is this night or is this day? Is this birth or is this death? Is this right or is this wrong? So Fuketsu answers the question with what he perceives to be the true question that's being asked here. So what does he say? He says, I often think fondly of Konon in March, the partridges chirp among the many scented flowers. So actually what he's saying is not original to him. This is a quote from a famous poet in China named Toho. That's his Japanese name, Toho, who lived in the 8th century China. So everybody would have known this quote at that time. It's kind of like, you know, you can't always get what you want, but you always get what you need. So, you know, this is a quote that everybody knew about. And it just probably just came to Fuketsu's mind, and so he said it. Konon is a place. Toho is saying that in March, he thinks of something he once saw and heard. Partridges chirping among a field of flowers. So I was kind of curious about partridges chirping. So I went on YouTube and, you know, Google and Googled what do partridges sound like and got a bunch of YouTube videos. And I have to say that their sound is not very melodious. Partridges kind of sound like chickens. Actually, they have some pretty harsh sounds that they make. So that's interesting in relationship to this story that we're talking about, this koan. So here we have this sense, this dichotomy again. We've got this we hear this quote and we think, ah, the beauty of the song of the partridges. So we're thinking more like meadowlarks in this beautiful field of spring flowers. And yet actually what Toho was talking about, he's saying, this is actually not very harmonious, at least to our ears. We have this kind of partridge business going on. And then, so that kind of feels very harmonious to our ears. And then we have this beautiful field of maybe wildflowers, which we do think is beautiful. So this is an awful lot like the question that the student asked. Because embedded in his response is this scene that Toho saw, that Toho says, I was very fond of this experience. So Toho's position is coming from this place of harmony, this place of luminosity, luminous place of differences and sameness merging together into one totality of all of life's functioning. So the partridges sound ugly, they are maybe form, and the flowers are so beautiful, maybe they are the absolute. Say, how do I respond to this? Toho says, nope, I think fondly of the scene. This is evocative of life's wondrous fullness. It is the wholehearted call of the partridges and the complete functioning of flowers. Both completely functioning, fulfilling their function without thinking about it, without thinking about what is ugly, what is beautiful. It is the totality of the partridges and the flowers together making up this life functioning. All of them are important. Maybe there are bees out there in that field as well, and little bugs on the ground, and there's dirt, and there's the sky and the sun. There are little partridge eggs and nests. All sorts of stuff going on out there. And there's Toho. Toho is there too. Don't forget Toho. And Fuketsu is there too, quoting Toho, and Dogen is quoting them both. This lineage of life, which is passed warm hand to warm hand, this one full experience, this moment of Toho's life, has been passed as wisdom. This is his wisdom that has been passed on from generation to generation. Now, it is being passed on to you, and many of you may already know this koan. So this koan has been passed on through the Mumon Kan for generations, hundreds of years. It is the source of wisdom, befuddlement, curiosity, frustration, elation for generations and generations of Zen students. It is also the intimacy of our experience freely given. So the poem expresses the liminal space between this or that. It is between way and re, or silence and speech. It is letting go of ugly and beautiful. Fuketsu and Toho are purely responding to what is asked in the moment. They're not caught by their ideas about their experience. Their responses see the Buddha-ness, the wholeness of life cycle, specifically the specificity of that moment. So this is not separate. That's also in this line. He's talking about a particular experience that he had. He's not talking about something very global. This is being expressed in the particular experience that Toho's having, in the particular experience of the student asking the question. That happened at a particular time, at a particular place. Dogen, paraphrasing and then quoting this poem, happened at a particular time and a particular place in the 13th century in Japan. This is happening at a particular time and a particular place. This is how we express our life. We can't express it in some kind of generalized way. We express it this moment, this moment, this moment, and this moment. So this is a story. This is a story of pure response. This is a story of how we conduct our life. There's a contemporary Chan monk named, I'll probably mispronounce his name, but it's G-U-O, Gyo Gu, G-U. He's a Dharma disciple of Sheng Yan. He's in his 50s now, a fairly well-known teacher. And his non-Buddhist name is Jimmy Yen. And Jimmy Yen, before he became Gao Gu, was, he was a hardcore band member. So he was a rocker. And then he went and became a Buddhist monk, and after that, and he also got his PhD in Buddhist studies. So he writes, actually, his commentary on this text is very down-to-earth, not intellectual at all. And he gives the example, he says that, he talks about that our goal in practice, our goal in practice for life, if you will, is to just do what you're doing without getting caught by our ideas about a situation. And I know we've all heard this teaching before. Instead, we just need to pay attention completely to the totality of our activity. And he gives this example of being a waitress or a waiter. He says, we just serve food and take care of the restaurant patron. We don't worry about if they say thank you or not, or even if they give us a tip. Or if we like their hair or their clothing. I've waited tables and, people come in and we all have ideas about people. We see somebody across a room or we're in a waiting room or we're talking to somebody and we have our likes and dislikes about how they are and who they are. So he says we should just let go of that. Let go of our likes and dislikes. The flowers in this koan, they don't criticize the partridge's call. Nor do the partridges say to themselves, oh, this field of flowers is oneness. I am having a deep experience of emptiness. Each element of Toto's description of that day in Konan is about this harmony of difference and sameness. It is particular and universal simultaneously. It is silence and speech simultaneously functioning like the front and back foot walking in the Sandokai. That's it. That's it. Nothing more. We hear the teaching in Zen a lot. Just do it. Don't analyze it. Not this, not that. On the other hand, sometimes we have to just make discernments. We have to distinguish between form and emptiness in order to mature our practice. Yet at some point, we have to step off the 100-foot pole. We have to stop defining practice to ourselves and just fully engage with the moment. And this fully engaging the moment could be pure response without thinking, or it can be bringing our focus back to include everyone, not just ourselves. Or it can be bringing our focus back to the self, if that's appropriate. The point here that I'm trying to make is that we also need to discriminate. We do discriminate. And we have to discern what's important in that discriminating. So we don't eat spoiled food because it's going to make us sick. And yet, often we discriminate based on likes and dislikes when we don't need to. When we can say to ourselves, is this really, really something that I need to resist? Or is this an idea I have? Is this a like or dislike? Is this something that I can just let go of and harmonize myself with the totality of this situation? I think we need to ask ourselves that question. And the way you know that you need to ask that question, or at least for myself, that's the way I know, is when negative emotions arise, when I get agitated or unhappy about something. Say, is this a like or a dislike? Is this really necessary? What if I just pay attention to the situation, the whole of the situation, which includes the totality of this? Can I see this? Can I understand this? So I'm going to end the lecture with this thought. On this spring equinox, entering that space between where there is not this or that, that space of birth and death, likes or dislikes, entering that space of allowing us to include everything, just feeling our body, seeing the bodies of others, feeling the breeze, vacuum the floor, drink your beer, and laugh, letting go. So, doing our best to accept our life as it is and to see the beauty of that life. Thank you.